this time, it gives me great pleasure to introduce your speaker for tonight, Hopper from Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Hopper, alcoholic. First, I want to thank Stan for asking me to come up and lead. I was at a camp out last weekend, an AA camp out, and I saw Stan put something up on Facebook, and I was like, get your ass over here and surprise everybody, but I didn't tell him where we were, and so he didn't make it. But I knew Stan from back in at the rescue mission in 2007. I went through the mission, and I stayed there, I keep going back as much as possible because it was part of a thing that changed my life. And we'll get to that later. But I do want to say, I want to welcome Albert and say happy birthday to Nikki and Vicki. And welcome our out-of-town guests from Sacramento. You know, it was, we almost missed this place. Well, we did. We drove right past the Thornburg or whatever, and when we finally found it, I was like, why didn't Stan just tell us, you know, right at the liquor store? I would have found it. I look back at it, and I think that's how I said most of my directions, you know, when I was just living what they said a normal life, but it was always, you know, turn at the liquor store, and then you'll get to Ralph's, and you turn there, and whatever had booze I could identify with. And then the whole thing is, I remember having my first drink, which is kind of weird, and I'm not sure if it's the first drink, but I remember the first time I got loaded, and it was a friend of mine that our parents were close friends, and they went out to a cocktail party, and he goes, Dave, he goes, come here, look at this. And, you know, he's got this big bottle of whiskey, and he's like, it's hard cider. And I'm like, you know, thinking to myself, bull crap, I know what a liquor bottle looks like because my parents were alcoholics. But I didn't refuse that, and at 9 years old, of course, I did 9 shots, and the next thing I know, I was laying on the floor at the end of Steve's bed, and this other guy, Chris, was in the other bed, and I heard Steve go, watch out, I think I'm going to get, and that's all I heard, and then splash across my chest, and we ended up, you know, both of us climbing into the shower to watch all this puke off, and then all of a sudden you hear his mom banging on the bathroom door, what are you guys doing in there? And we're like, nothing. And she opens the door, she can tell we're loaded, and we get put back into Steve's room, and we each have a bucket. And, you know, and I'll never remember, she called my dad, and my dad shows up. And I have 2 older brothers and an older sister, and the whole family was dysfunctional, and I say that, and then somebody says, you know why it was a dysfunctional family? It's because you were in it. My dad came walking into that room, and we're both sitting there puking into these buckets, and he starts laughing, and Lucy, my buddy's mother's friend's name, she's one of those mothers that's flipping out, you know, Mrs. Cleaver, and she's going, my God, Jim, look at him, you know, this is horrible, and he just says, well, do you ever think they're going to drink like this again? Little did he know, but by the time I turned 13, I was a full-blown alcoholic, drug addict, and I grew up in upstate New York, and it was a beautiful town for people to grow up in, and, you know, it was, the school I actually went to was Ichabod Crane, if you believe that one, and it's the home of Martin Van Buren, a great town for everyone to grow up until you're 18, and then there's nothing to do except sit at the bar or do drugs, I got a job right away after, you know, when I was 13, right in the restaurant business, and that was perfect because I found out that, you know, washing dishes that the cook will set you up with the beers afterwards, so it was ideal. And then, you know, at 18, you were able to, that's when you turned legal to drink. And by that time, life had gone to hell. I'd been thrown out of a couple schools, and by the time I was 13, let me go back, when I was 13, this is my dysfunctional family. My oldest brother, I found out, was hitting on all my sister's friends. He would get them all goaded and then take advantage of my sister's friends. And then my second oldest brother was getting me and my friends all loaded, and then he was hitting on all my friends. So there was the dysfunction, and then my sister not knowing what the hell to do. My parents had an open door policy where anybody could do whatever, and I just kind of slid around through the cracks of everything and stayed with the restaurant work so I could get loaded all the time. And you know, drugs was a part of my story. I started, you know, shooting up cocaine at you know, in my teens, and that, you know, life just, it wasn't going too pleasant, I should say. And I left New York thinking, okay, you know, geographical, I'm going to go to the Carolinas, and I'd go down to the Carolinas, and I think this is perfect, and I get into Godfather's Pizza, and then I go to this place, Western Sizzlin', and I'm figuring I'll work gung-ho, and they said, okay, well, you know, we'll hire you. You need to get a haircut. And I was like, crap, you know, and this was, you know, the 70s or 80s by now. And I had the long hair, and I walk out, and I see a barber's pole, and I'm like, perfect. And I go in, and I'm like, how much for a haircut? The guy says, $4. And I'm like, well, shoot, they charge $12 in New York. Cut away. And next thing I know, I hear, and that he shaves my head, and I'm like, oh, shit, you're, excuse my language. But and I get done with the haircut, and I walk out, and there's a big sign that says, send more Johnson Air Force Base. And I'm like, I'll be damned, you know. And then about a month later, they want to give everybody a polygraph test because somebody's selling drugs in there. And I'm new to this place. And that's where I was getting my weed. And then next thing I know, they're telling me I'm fired because I'm the one selling the drugs. And I'm like, you're full of crap, you know. I don't even know anybody. But that didn't make things worse. It just kind of was like, screw you, and I stuck with Godfather's Pizza until alcohol started running that show again, and I ended up getting arrested for a switchblade on some guy, and he was the one who started it, of course, you know, but my alcoholic mind is, you know, why am I in trouble with this knife in my hand? And I left that state, and I went back to New York, and that didn't change, so it was back, right back down. I moved to Florida, and it wasn't an eye-opener, because it was just back into the restaurants and getting fired from every restaurant that I walked into, because my drinking exceeded it. And by this time, I was so far into my alcoholism and drug addiction that any type of relationship with any kind of human being or a relationship with myself or a relationship with God was out the window. I had married alcohol and I had married drugs. It was my number one priority in life. And it took away every single thing that was dysfunctional in my life. And that was pretty much everything. And, you know, it got to the point where in Florida that people are saying, you know, you're really screwing up, and we don't, you know, I started becoming homeless in Florida. And we were talking about on the ride up here, Keith and Pete and I, about the first time having the shakes. And that was the first time I remember having full-on seizures and being put into a drug and alcohol, whatever it was, detox and leaving and going right back under the bridge and started hitting the crack pipe. And that's when I started freebasing back in New York, but I found the crack in Florida, and drugs was a part of my story, but alcohol was in my hand at all times any drugs came into my life. And it was, you know, I that all kept escalating, and finally I lost the jobs doing the kitchen work, and nobody would hire me until somebody said, you know how to clean fish, how about a commercial fishing boat? And I moved to the Carolinas and got on a shark fishing boat. And that was one of the most beautiful things in my life. You know, the ocean was, I could get away from everybody and everything. But I would come back in and reality was there on shore. And I didn't know how to live in reality, so it was get me the hotel room, get me the girl, and get me the bottle of whiskey and the crack cocaine. The weekend was over. I'm broke, you know, a few $1,000s out the window, and I'm back onto the boat and just doing this for years all through the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico and neglecting every single part of my family's life that was back home. My dad passed, and I just shot home and said, you know, goodbye, whatever, and then just left again. And I get back down to Florida, and they had stopped the commercial shark fishing because they said that we were catching way too many. And that's when I said, you know, I'm going to go back to New York, and I, you know, that trip thing, and I get back there, and sure enough, I, you know, get a DUI, you know, picking up my brother at the bar. It wasn't my fault. It was his fault that he was at the bar. And the police didn't see it that way. And it was like, I'm getting out of here, and I came to California, and I figured I can do the fishing here. And when I got to California, it was no different. You know, I found the same friends, you know, where it says in the book that, you know, we'll hang with lower companions. Well, I found some of them, and this was in 95. By 96 came, my roommates, you know, living in a nice house on the Mesa, said, you know, you're screwing up bad. You know, you're not going to make it if you keep doing all this cocaine and drinking. And I said, all right, I'll go into the rescue mission. And I got into the rescue mission, and that's when the Bethel House was on the same property as the rescue mission. Big mistake. And but, you know, I was working in the kitchen, so they said, you know what, we're going to let you go over to the Bethel House, and then you can take their inventory. And I took that a little too far, and I got into a relationship with, you know, this beautiful woman, and I didn't know what I was doing because I'd never done the steps and I'd never surrendered before. And what I did is I gave up the alcohol and the drugs for this woman. And we hid everything away, and it was fine. And until finally we're at the pier, and I saw one of the guys that work at the mission. And I'm like, oh, shit, tomorrow he's going to really ream us one because we're not supposed to be in a relationship, not fraternizing anything. And so I see the guy the next morning, and I'm like, hey, Randy, what you saw on the pier was not what it looked like. We were just holding hands, and we're friends. And he goes, you know, he's like, what in the hell are you talking about? I didn't even see you on the pier last night. And I'm like, oh, crap, you know. It ends up that they bring us into the office, and they're like, okay, you know, they said, she's got to go. And I was like, no, this was my fault. I brought it on. And they said, no, she's been in more trouble, and she's got to leave. And, you know, and I'll never forget watching her put her stuff in her sister's car and take off. And I just went down to the liquor store and got my big gulp glass and, you know, my orange juice and vodka and walked around the mission for the next few days, just loaded as could be. And then finally somebody came up with a bunch of somas, and the whole kitchen crew took them, and they called us the Soma 7. Some kid walked up, you know, looking like a bowl of jelly into the director's office, and they said, okay, everybody's got to go. And by that time I had burned all my bridges and with my family and friends and everything, in every state that I had lived in. And a year prior, I'd gone down the beach, and I drove past all the homeless along the palm trees there in Santa Barbara, and I said, that's one thing I'll never be, is I'll never end up homeless like those guys. And there I was a year later, and, you know, I wake up outside of the drum circle, and I can't find my shoes, can't find my backpack, and some homeless guy comes walking up, and he's like, hey, boy, you missing these things? And And that was it. And I started my homeless adventure. And, you know, the guilt and shame came over and everything like that. But then I'm like, you know, the manipulating alcoholic is, I can make this look good. And I'm not homeless. I'm just here to stand up for the homeless rights, you know. And you know, so my I talked to my sister on the phone, and she goes, "Is it true you're flying a sign on the road?" And I said, "Whoever told you that's full of crap," you know. And my whole family knew. And then that's when I kept saying, "Okay, I mean, I'm going to be the advocate, and I'm going to save all these guys out on the streets." And that was in '96, and then about 5 years had gone by, and it was to the point where I was down. I was the guy in the trench coat with the brown paper bag laying in the gutter, and you know, pissing his pants and eating out of the trash can, and then it started getting comfortable because I was in that black hole of alcoholism, and I had no way out. You know, and it talks about that in A Vision for You, when it says, you know, further and further we break away from society, and that's the way I was. You know, I was caught up in my own little world, and I didn't hurt anybody as long as I stayed in my little seclusion, which I thought. And it was around 2000 or whatever, and I sat there and I said, okay, I'm going to give this another shot, and I went into detox. And then I found out about the spiritual malady and my allergic reaction to sobriety. And it wasn't working, you know. I get in there and the detox guy's like, put him on the floor. He's going to go into a seizure if he's sitting up or anything like that. And every time I'd go into jail, it was the same thing. Put a mat on the floor. He's going to go into a seizure. And by this time, I started developing physical illnesses from alcoholism and drug addiction. And today, you know, I have a permanent limp, and I'll never have my balance back because I ate a part of my cerebellum. I mean, alcohol was a morning, day, night. Whenever I was awake, alcohol had to be in my hand or in my system. And I got to the point where I went to that detox, and they weren't testing me or anything because I was on so many pain meds from the physical illnesses, where I was just doing whatever I wanted anyhow, and I was spiritually sick and had no idea what the hell I was anyhow. And I just went back out onto the streets. And to this day, I don't know how many people I saw die out there, and I can't even remember most of their names. But it came down to a group of us. There were three of us, Don and James and I, and our dog Brandy. And finally, you know, and I remember this one guy, Kelly, who was a good friend of mine up on the stage at Pershing Park down in Santa Barbara. And I don't know how many people have been close to death, but you can smell death. And I was laying there with Kelly, and I could smell him. I knew he was dying. And the only thing I could do was say, here, Kelly, let me get you another bottle of vodka and make this comfortable. And then it got to the point where, you know, they took Kelly away, and then drinking with Don and James. And I went to hand Don a bottle, and blood was trickling out of his mouth. And I was like, well, that's probably going to be the last time we see Don. And sure enough, he went into a coma and passed. And then the police started having bets on who was going to last longer, myself or James. And they said Hopper's going to be the first one to go. And that, you know, and then James's stomach started blowing up, and he went into a hospice place, the Sarah House. And I just saw that lady 2 days ago, and that used to run the place, and she was in tears when we talked a couple of days ago about how sweet of a guy he was. But he left the Sarah House and came back, and he said, Hopper, let's go finish this off. Let's just grab a couple of bottles and go up into the mountains. And saying that, we tried this once before. We went up into the mountains to detox, and what a mistake. We had a bottle of whiskey and a case of beer, and we made it to Four Bush, and then we ran out of booze, and and here we are, we have 80-pound packs and everything like this, and we got the dog, and we start going further, and we get to this one spot where I went into a grandma seizure and almost went off the cliff, and Edwin, another dear friend that just passed two weeks ago, tomorrow, but he was able to grab me by my belt, and there was my adventure into the mountains, you know, the helicopter had to fly us out of there. Three homeless guys saved in the National Los Padres forest, and you know, but then James came up and he wanted to do this all over again. And I knew that what he wanted to do is just go back and let, you know, nature take its course and die. And I said no. And he went up for a little bit and he came back down and you know, I won't forget the, at this point I was getting sick so much with vomiting blood, and I went from a wheelchair to it, you know, and it was just, it was not a good scene. And then I was watching James getting sick right in front of me and turning and looking, you know, saying, call the ambulance. And I froze because I saw myself, I saw Kelly, I saw Don, and I saw the other people that had died before me, and I froze. And he crawled past me and dialed 911, and the ambulances came, the fire department, and they were like, do you want to say goodbye to James? And I was like, no, but I need another drink. You know, and I sat there and I didn't want to say goodbye because I just don't like the words goodbye. And but I wanted that drink. And they took James and I got my drink. James got his wish and passed. And I went on for another binger, and that was in 2007. And I was down to 130 pounds and just, you know, I don't know how many times in and out of jail and the hospital when this girl, she was my guardian angel, and she came down and she just was persistent saying, Hopper, you're dying. And I welcomed the idea. I prayed to God every night. I wouldn't wake up in the morning anyhow. And I, you know, I was like, whatever, Stacy. And she goes, just tell him you're going to kill yourself. Please tell him you're going to kill yourself so I can get you a place to stay. And I sat there and I was like, all right. And so I convinced them I was going to kill myself, and, you know, sat in the rubber room for a while. And she was just kept coming back every day, bringing me smokes and bringing me a little bit of encouragement that it's going to be okay. And I finally, with a donor, paid for a month's rent of sober living until I could try and get into the rescue mission again. And I went into the sober living and got to the rescue mission, and he wasn't going to let me in because he thought I was going to die on their premises, and it just wasn't a good thing. And I was able to finally convince him. And then I just sat there and I kept looking up at this little cross that's up on one of the sides of the buildings and just saying, you know, why did you keep me alive? You know, and I kept asking why this, why that? And then finally I realized that why is not a good question, because God can do whatever he wants, or she, or whatever God is. And I, you know, and I, and then it was, what is it you want me to do? And then it was, the only thing that I could think of was try and help somebody not do, take the path that I took. And then I looked at Stacy and I was like, okay, she's a drug and alcohol counselor. She does homeless outreach. That's what I want to do. So in order for me to go and go out and advocate for the homeless, I'd better put something behind my name, getting the certificate or whatnot, because every time I went to a city hall meeting or board of supervisors, they automatically, you know, the cops would be putting their gloves on and I'd get arrested and escorted out. But this time they knew I was for real. I went and got certified and did the certification at City College and then was asked to be the South Coast Homeless Advisory Committee homeless representative. But I started doing my internship with CARES. A good friend of mine, Jennifer Ferrez, a social worker, she was the one taking me through my internship. And so I go out onto State Street to do some of my first outreach stuff. And the first person I run into is my guardian angel sitting there holding a sign saying, please help. hungry and lonely, tired. And I was like, Stacy, there's nothing I can do. I can't take you back to where I was staying. I couldn't make the promises that she had promised me. And it ended up she died a couple months later. And, you know, it was an eye-opener, but it was, you know, it encouraged me more to get on with this. And I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was, you know, two things I did not want in my life was to say I was an alcoholic, and the second one was to go to these stupid-ass meetings. And the two things that I love the most today is saying that I'm an alcoholic and I love going to these meetings. And, you know, I was beaten into a sense of reasonableness where alcohol was just, it wasn't a question anymore. But for me, looking at everybody walking around and having jobs, and, you know, I sit there and I watch this guy pull up in his car, and he gets out with his wife and his kids, and he's got a clean haircut and a suit and a tie, and I'm thinking, what the hell's wrong with this guy? You know, nothing wrong with him. It's me sitting there. And, you know, if 8 years ago, if I was sitting in the park and told you I'd be standing up here with a gray button-down shirt and a pink tie on, you know, that you guys would be laughing. You'd be like, bull crap, you'll be pushing a shopping cart with freaking crap on your pants and the same clothes you had on 2 years ago. And that's what I thought it was going to be. But, you know, with when, you know, the admitting I was powerless and my life was unmanageable, that was easy because, I mean, it was just obvious. And then came to believe, you know, that God couldn't restore, came to believe that God could restore me to sanity. That was okay. And then, you know, and then turning my will and my life over to the care of God. And, you know, and I was talking with Pete about that on the ride up. And turning my will over, that means, you know, that I've got to turn my thoughts and my judgments and my opinions over to God. You know, how am I going to do without making a little list saying, hey, I want to hold on to some of these things over here. But, you know, it was, you know, the way I put it today is I let go of the steering wheel and I let God drive the car, because every time I drove the car, I would just end up hitting a blank wall, you know, a rock wall. And, you know, I did the fourth step, and I looked back at some of the deaths that happened in my life. I had one from back in when I was a teen that I saw a couple of guys that hit a couple of hits of acid, and one of them turned around to the other one and just shot him point blank range, and I held on thinking, you know, if I'd never done that, those, you know, he'd be alive today and blah, blah, blah. And it took me a while to figure out I didn't pull that trigger, and I didn't pour the booze down James's throat. I did not understand, you know, I looked for my part and what my brother had done to me, and where in the fourth step it says they are sick people too. You know, I didn't understand that he did not ask to be a homosexual. He did not ask to be an alcoholic. Those were things that were given to him in God instincts. And I was given my own God instincts. You know, my ambitions, my securities, my personal relationships. And those are all, you know, things that I live with on a daily basis. But I abused all those things my whole life. I took advantage of everything like that so it would come my way. I made judgment on everything. You know, it's you know, I sit there and say, borrow $100 from Tom, and I sit there and say, Tom, I'll pay you back on Tuesday. Tuesday rolls around, and Tom says, hey, you got that $100? And I'd be like, why are you always fucking picking on me? You know? But, you know, I look back at all those things, and one of the biggest things that really got me is I was told to get commitments, so I got commitments. I was asked to get a home group, so I've got a home group. It's Men Who Have Lost Their Legs. It's a men's stag on Thursday night at 8 o'clock, and if any of you guys are around down in Santa Barbara, you're more than welcome. It's about 120 guys and some really good sobriety. And the commitments, you know, I've got those. But it was, It was not under, it was still the not understanding how to live life without any kind of substance and not having God in my life and not, you know, being able to control the things I wanted. And then it was just told to me that, you know, faith kills that fear, because I was living in a bundle of fear my whole life. I didn't know what you thought of me because of something that happened 20 years ago that you don't even have any idea happened, but, you know, you're still judging me, which I thought, you know, I knew exactly what you guys thought about me before I came walking in the door tonight. But, you know, it's those things that I lived in. And then I, you know, when it sits there and it talks about the actor who very much wants to run the show, and Bill was a big drama person in New York City and always went to the theater, and he used that analogy, or the jaywalker. You know, I love those analogies of I can do this and I've got it under control, you know, and it mentions delusion 3 different times in the book, you know, where my thinking is not right. You know, when there's something that's not true, I've got the delusion that says it's true. And also they're painting a beautiful illusion of me sitting on the front porch having a beer with a dog on my side and everything's perfect. And that delusion, I used to believe it was going to happen, you know. And until I came to the realization of I'm not the director of the show, you know, that my jaywalking is never going to fix itself. And until I let go of the control, let go of the steering wheel, you know, and it says right after, it says, you know, this is the hell and why of it, that we had to quit playing God. You know, and then on the next page saying, if we do his work well, he will provide. And that was me, always worried about what the hell I'm going to get out of life, or what's, you know, what is somebody going to give me, or what does somebody think of me, instead of just saying, Hopper, kick back, you know, let God play this deal, you know, because I did not know how to live life on life's terms. These slogans, you know, that says, you know, but by the grace of God, I've got that on my arm, because I never want to forget, you know, that where I stand today and, you know, God giving me a few chances back in life, that it's all his grace. Everything that I've got today is by the grace of God. And I'm going to steal this from a speaker that I've heard or whatever. It's about an old Chinese proverb of the Chinaman and his son are out doing the fields every single day. And all of a sudden the horse gets up and it runs off. And now they don't have anything. They're poor as could be. And all everybody comes over and gives the condolences to this man and his son. And they said, you know, what now? And he goes, I don't know. And then next thing you know, the horse comes running back and has got a whole bunch of more horses, and he's the richest man in town. And the neighbors come up and said, hey, you're the richest man in town. You know, what are you going to do now? And he goes, I don't know. And then the next thing you know is his son gets sick and they have to amputate his leg. And they're like, what are you going to do about your son? And he goes, I don't know. And then all of a sudden this guy comes and he says, hey, there's a war coming on and we're drafting all the kids. Everybody's got to go. And this is a fight where nobody's going to return, but we can't take your son. What do you think about that? And he goes, I don't know. And it just, you know, and it just shows me that I don't know a damn thing about what's going to happen in life. And if I try and take the wheel and I try and drive it to where I want to go, instead of letting God just do the natural thing of placing me where he's going to place me and accepting what's where I'm at, you know, life is, you know, they talk about the profound alteration into the reaction of life. And that's what happened. You know, I look at life totally different now, that it's not about what am I going to get out of the pie. It's what can I bring to the table. You know, I go into the jails every Wednesday night, and I look forward so much to Wednesday nights going into the jail. I still do the homeless outreach. You know, I was with a little organization and I backed off from them, but how the hell can I back off from doing something I enjoy? We went to this camp out last weekend, and I swore up and down, I'm not doing any freaking cooking this time. I'm not getting involved, you know. I'm getting screwed on this deal. And the camp out's over, and Pete goes, boy, you sure stayed away from the grill, huh? You know, working, was out there doing the eggs and the bacon, and, but, you know, it's those things that I found. We've got a barbecue coming up tomorrow at Lower Manning Park, if anybody's in Santa Barbara. It's for the Alamo Club, and it's a big-ass barbecue. There's going to be tri-tip and fresh tuna. But, and I've been involved in cooking with them from my first year in 07. But when I turn around and I see 250 people smiling and joking and hugging one another, that's a payoff, you know? And when I'm out working with some of the homeless or whatever and just seeing a glimmer of hope that maybe, you know, you think you might be able to get me housed? No, but we can fill out this application. And just seeing a glimmer of hope there. You know, when I find that I'm not in Hopper's head, I do okay. You know, and all it is just me remembering that I don't run the show. That God's got, he's got me. And talks about walking hand in hand with the Spirit. And I believe that so much. It's just me trying not to run that show. And, you know, Albert and whoever else is new, I hope you find what I found. And you know, I sit there and I still get the, I look back and I see when my ego's kicking in, and that tends to be when I start getting depressed, which means if I'm getting depressed, that means I'm trying to steal the driving wheel away from God again. But I know I'm happiest when I'm not in charge. So, you know, if you're new, I want to welcome you so much, and I really do hope you stick around. And, you know, I do want to thank Stan for asking me to come up. So, Stan, I just want to give you a moment of silence for 1 second. Okay, that's good enough. But I don't see Jason here tonight, but I'll get on him later. And you know, I'm trying to. I really can't think of anything because I'm going blank right now. I don't know. Anyhow, I do know one thing, that I didn't have a drink today, and that's a miracle. So if you're new, keep coming back, and thank you for having me up here, Stan.
Our speaker will be up here after the meeting to thank for him coming all the way to Santa Barbara. And we can give him another hand. Everybody.